This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal land. Tonight, millions of Optus customers, past and present, on alert for identity theft after the telco's records were compromised in a cyber attack. Also, Ukraine's leader appeals to UN members for more military support amid widespread condemnation of Russia's plans to scale up the war effort.
This is inviting a bloodbath on a much larger scale. Sadly, we're looking down the barrel of incredible hardship and pain for the people of Ukraine and for many of those people from Russia who are going to be put through the meat grinder.
And the Governor General acknowledges different reactions to the Queen's death on this National Day of Mourning as Australians enjoy a public holiday.
It's a very sad time. I think today is a good celebration for her passing.
I've recently converted from a Republican to a monarchist.
How did that conversion happen?
As sad as it sounds, I watched The Crown on Netflix.
Thanks for your company. First tonight, a major security breach impacting possibly millions of customers of one of the country's biggest telecommunications companies. Optus is scrambling to respond to a cyber attack which has seen information stolen, including names, dates of birth and phone numbers. For some, it goes even further with passport and driver's license numbers compromised, although the company insists all payment and account details remain secure. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
It's one of Australia's largest telecommunications companies. Now a cyber attack has left its millions of customers exposed. Chief Executive Kelly Bayer-Rosmarin spoke to ABC News.
Unfortunately, we became aware late yesterday that there was unusual activity that was a cyber attack. And unfortunately, some unknown actors have managed to access our customers' information. It involves both current and former customers, and so we're still really in the throes of investigating exactly what information has been accessed and working with all the authorities and others to try and determine who has accessed it and for what purpose.
She says it's too early to say how many Optus customers may be affected. Government bodies and the Australian Federal Police have been notified.
Our team had noticed some unusual activity. They'd immediately moved to stop that unusual activity and to block the attack from occurring. And then we did a whole bunch of work to really understand what had happened, to look at the logs and to get to the bottom of what could have been causing that unusual activity, and came to the conclusion that it was a cyber attack by yesterday.
She outlines the information that's been accessed.
Yeah, so some of the information is information that you would find on Facebook or LinkedIn profiles, customer names, date of birth, their contact phone number and email address. But in some cases, we've also noticed that what's been accessed is the identification number that could be the driver's license number, or in a rare number of cases, the passport and the mailing address.
Investigations are ongoing, but Optus says payment details and account passwords have not been compromised and services are unaffected. Customers with heightened risks will be personally notified. Microsoft Regional Director Troy Hunt says once that type of information is out there, it's difficult to get it back.
In terms of the significance, when we see things like customers' names and dates of birth and phone numbers, this is the sort of information that's very often used for things like identifying yourself. So to have that information on potentially a large number of people would be concerning.
What can somebody do with this once they've got hold of it?
Well, there's lots of different possibilities here. So we don't know what's happened in the lead up to this. So very often we see actors gain access to information and then attempt to ransom a company. So was there perhaps a ransom involved? Very often non-payment of a ransom results in the leakage of data. Now, there's no mention of that here, but that's something that does happen on many occasions. And then, of course, the information itself is valuable. Very often it is sold in bulk.
Cybersecurity expert Robert Potter, who co-founded Canberra-based consultancy Internet 2.0, says while it's not unheard of for telecommunications companies to be breached, it's uncommon in Australia.
Well, based on the disclosure from Optus, it looks like a pretty profound breach of customer data. that they're describing access to things that are generally pretty hard for threat actors to get access to in a hurry. So usually when we see large amounts of customer data from big companies that have reasonably good cybersecurity like Optus does, it's usually a sign that someone who knew what they were doing got into the network.
The onus will now be on customers to mitigate their risk of identity theft.
It'll be left to users to go through the process of changing those passport details, changing their driver's license details so that someone couldn't potentially use that information to steal their identity down the track.
What is the message that customers should be taking away from what's coming out so far today?
From an individual point of view, you want to be just making sure that if you share your Optus passwords with other accounts, it might be a good time to just, you know, do the proactive thing and change those passwords. I think definitely don't panic. Treat this as another in a long line of breaches.
That's cybersecurity expert Robert Potter ending that report from Alexandra Humphreys. AFL boss Gillon McLachlan today voiced his support for greater Indigenous representation at club level, possibly even quotas, in the wake of damning allegations of mistreatment of First Nations players at the Hawthorn Football Club. Amid calls for more widespread reviews on how the AFL deals with Indigenous players, some of their families say there are already effective programs in some clubs which, if adopted more widely, could make a big difference. Jane Barden reports.
When her grandson, Malcolm Roses Jr., was given an offer to move from Darwin to play for the Gold Coast Suns, aged 17, 4 years ago, Eileen Cummings was worried.
Because of Adam Goods and all the other players that have gone through some terrible issues, you know.
Her family's experience of racism stretches back to her nephew Essendon star Michael Long calling out a slur by an opponent during the 1995 Anzac Day match. The allegations about clubs have kept coming. So before her grandson moved to Queensland, the family went to see the club's Indigenous program in action.
And they've got a really good setup there. And the fella that is actually running that is a former player from Queensland. He's Aboriginal. We've seen when they had the Indigenous round, what he'd done to help his young players.
She's shocked by allegations from former Hawthorn players that they suffered mistreatment, including being isolated from their families, which the club's coaches have denied. So she's calling on clubs around the country to replicate the culture she's seen at Gold Coast.
They allow them to talk about home and where they come from, but also take them out on fishing trips and things like that so that the boys are relaxed and they're not worrying about things. And I think if any of them do have concerns, they've got this branch that they can go to. And some of the development officers are great.
Some of the former players who've played for all different clubs have really complained that there was pressure to not be connected with family still. I mean, did you find that Gold Coast has really enabled your grandson to come home when needed?
Yep. He came home for his father's funeral. He came up for his cousin's funeral. So they allow them to do that sort of thing.
Hawthorn is still considering how to respond after its review into former players' allegations. Former Adelaide Crows player Eddie Betts received an apology from his club and the AFL over cultural insensitivity at a pre-season training camp in 2018. He's told Fox he wants league-wide reviews of club culture.
Every football club should come out and do an external review, contact, you know, the Indigenous players, the past Indigenous players, and see how that footy club was.
AFL clubs aren't offering such a review. AFL CEO Gillon McLachlan wants Indigenous members on every AFL club board.
I'd like Indigenous representation at every club. I think quotas is a broader discussion.
He plans to announce a four-member panel which will review the Hawthorn allegations for the AFL on Friday.
I've been interviewing prospective panellists this morning. I've been liaising with the representative of the complainants.
Gold Coast player Malcolm Roses was offered a place at one of the big Melbourne clubs, but he declined.
I said, don't you want to go? No, I'll stay here because I think he felt secure. I think he felt he had the support there.
Eileen Cummings thinks if clubs don't change their culture, other players will also vote with their feet.
Every club has to address it. in some shape or form, but if they don't, it just festers. And then you get players like Eddie Betts and Goods coming out later in life talking about it.
She thinks change in the sport will also require change community-wide.
We've had racism and all of that all our lives. It's nothing new to us, but I think it's time that Australia really put its foot down. And as a nation, we're all Australians, you know. We all want to play sport. We all want to do things within our country. So allow us to do that.
That's Eileen Cummings speaking to Jane Barden in Darwin. Ukraine's president has addressed the United Nations General Assembly, calling for Russia to face just punishment as it prepares to dramatically escalate its invasion. Speaking via video, Volodymyr Zelensky pleaded for more military support and requested the creation of a special war tribunal amid more allegations of war crimes by Russian forces.
Ukraine demands punishment for trying to steal our territory, punishment for the murders of thousands of people, punishment for tortures and humiliations of women and men, punishment for the catastrophic turbulence that Russia provoked with its illegal war, and not only for us, Ukrainians, but for the whole world.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. On the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg, hundreds of protesters were arrested during rallies against the Russian president's order to draft some 300,000 reservists to join the war. Flights out of Russia quickly sold out in the hours after the announcement. Well, John Blaxland is a professor of international security and intelligence studies at the Australian National University. We spoke earlier.
This is a very clear indication that Putin is not planning to back down and that he's planning to continue with his war for quite a long time. The recruiting and pulling in 300,000 soldiers is going to take quite some time. These are people who have had only rudimentary training. Many of them will be quite unfit. But this is certainly an indication that we're about to see conflict ratcheted up, not ratcheted down.
And of those 300,000, assuming that there can be that many actually called up, will Russia be able to arm them and find officers to lead them?
So I don't think there's any question that Russia has enough weapons and equipment to arm and kit them out. They have it. The question is, in what condition is it in? It's likely to be not in very good condition. And your point about leadership is a very good one. The Russian army is already suffering severely from poor leadership. Finding the leaders for 300,000 additional troops for an army that has actually not been geared for mass call-up for generations is actually hugely problematic. And in fact, what we're seeing is the generation of what is probably going to be cannon fodder for the Ukrainian forces. This is inviting a bloodbath on a much larger scale. Sadly, there'll be many, many more Russians who are going to die in this conflict unnecessarily as a result.
President Putin repeated the point in his speech that it was only a partial mobilisation. Clearly, he's playing to concerns from regular Russian families there about their children being conscripted to war. But at the same time, he's trying to keep the pro-war nationalists within Russia on side as well, with a lot of that kind of fire and fury in his rhetoric.
So the warlike ultranationalists are exactly the problem at the moment that Vladimir Putin is trying to placate by going down this path. But this is a path of perdition. He is opening up a Pandora's box of potential problems that could well come back to haunt him. He is transforming this from a special military operation to a war unlike anything Russia has seen since 1945. Unfortunately, also, he's employing tactics that echo the warfare of that era. This is massed artillery. It's large-scale infantry and mechanized infantry operations that involve massed troops, but they're fighting not the Wehrmacht of 1945. They're fighting a modern, combined arms, sophisticated Ukrainian force that has adopted to NATO-like standards and methodologies. that are about precision, about manoeuvre, about flexible response, and about avoiding hard spots and going for soft spots. Putin still retains the ability to inflict enormous pain on Ukraine through the long-range weapons and missiles that he can fire at infrastructure across much of Ukraine. So, and sadly, we're looking down the barrel of incredible hardship and pain for the people of Ukraine and for many of those people from Russia who are going to be put through the meat grinder.
Ukraine has already reinstated its calls for more military assistance, including from Australia. Does Ukraine have any option but to meet this challenge with its own kind of overwhelming force?
So there's a real danger here that Ukraine will be encouraged to go beyond what is sustainable. There is a fine balance between what can be expected to be achieved and what threshold Putin is prepared to tolerate before he will go where we've all thought was unthinkable and has been for the last 70 plus years. So this is a real conundrum because Putin is in a danger. There's no existential threat to Russia, but there is an existential threat to Putin. And that is the most dangerous aspect of this whole equation.
John Blaxland, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Professor John Blaxland there from the Australian National University. This is PM. I'm David Lipson. Ahead, artwork generated by artificial intelligence can create anything you want to see, but who owns the copyright?
You can say something like, give me a photo of a dog jumping over water. And it's able to do that because, you know, through this training of millions and millions of images, it learned how these language concepts relate to visual concepts.
With words of praise, song, and sprigs of golden wattle, it was today Australia's turn to mark the death of Queen Elizabeth II. The National Day of Mourning was led by a heartfelt ceremony at Parliament House in Canberra, where the country's leaders paid tribute to the monarch and her enduring influence on Australia. But for many First Nations people, it was a reminder of the painful legacy of colonisation, sparking protests in cities across the nation. Matt Bamford reports.
From across the country, they came to Canberra, the nation's leaders arriving at Parliament House with quiet reverence. State and territory leaders, governors-general and public servants were among the hundreds gathered. Inside the Great Hall, Queen Elizabeth's words rang out from the building she opened in 1988.
Which is both the living expression of that federation and the embodiment of the democratic principles of freedom, equality, and justice. Parliamentary democracy is a compelling ideal, but it is a fragile institution. It cannot be imposed, and it is only too easily destroyed.
Fresh off the plane from London, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese spoke of Her Majesty's unwavering support for Australia, even as it stepped out of Britain's shadow.
She greeted every evolution in our relationship with Britain with good grace and an abiding faith in the judgment of the Australian people. And so, amidst the noise and turbulence of the decades, the Queen endured. And so did Australians' affection for her.
After more than 70 years on the throne, Mr. Albanese said it was the Queen's dedication to public service that Australians can most admire.
Perhaps the greatest tribute we can offer her family and her memory is not a marble statue or a metal plaque. It is a renewed embrace of service to community, the most fitting memorial to a magnificent life of service to others.
Opposition leader Peter Dutton praised her commitment to the Commonwealth, a connection that spans much of the globe.
That equal partnership of nations and races, as she described it, built on friendship, loyalty, and the desire for freedom and peace.
On her first visit in 1954, Queen Elizabeth was gifted a brooch of golden wattle, a memento she returned with in 1988 to open the Parliament. Today, mourners laid sprigs of the bright native flower in her honour, a uniquely Australian tribute. It's also a chance to reflect on the challenges of Australia's colonial past, and Governor-General David Hurley acknowledged the pain of many First Nations people.
I'm conscious and respect that the response of many First Nations Australians is shaped by our colonial history and broader reconciliation journey. That is a journey we as a nation must complete.
Those different reactions were on show in cities across Australia on this day of national mourning. In Melbourne's Federation Square, Green Senator Lydia Thorpe led the crowd.
And you want to mourn the colonizer who brought the pain and the genocide?
In Adelaide, this man was detained after disrupting a ceremony at Government House.
From colonial aggression, a colonial oppression that's been here for hundreds of years that oppressed the Indigenous people of this country. And why are we here today? Why are we having this public holiday?
And in Brisbane, a small crowd watched as the Australian flag was burned. Outside Sydney's town hall, emotions were raw.
Why am I protesting today? Because the government has called this a day of mourning. Yet our people have been calling for the same respect as a day of mourning since 1938 and has fallen upon deaf ears. So it's our turn to give them what they give us. Nothing.
But for those marking the occasion with reverence in Canberra, it was time to emphatically ring in the reign of King Charles. At the end of the second Elizabethan era, a day of conflicting emotions has set the scene for a new chapter in Australia's history.
Matt Bamford with that report. So how have Australians been reflecting on the Queen and her legacy today? Sarah Sedgie prepared this report.
In St John's Anglican Cathedral in Parramatta in Sydney's west, hundreds came together to honour the life of the Queen.
She was constant, she was honourable, and her service was impeccable to all of the people in the Commonwealth, and I think that should be celebrated in a sense of joy.
She had an amazing life, and I've been struggling. I'm still sort of struggling to accept that she's gone.
For some, the Queen was an unwavering constant over decades of change.
I was a young boy when she was crowned Queen in 1953. I mean, at the beginning, people were talking about seeing her coronation in television. Of course, in Australia, we didn't, because TV didn't come here until 56. So we didn't see that. So since her reign began, we've had a number of little wars that have been worse in many ways than the World War II. But also, we've seen a burgeoning of technology. We've got things like mobile phones, and I taught children who have no idea about telephones where you've got to put your finger in and move it around. So the change that has taken place over this past 70 years is astronomical.
The depth of feeling has surprised Reverend David Old, Senior Associate Minister of the Church.
I think we're just tremendously surprised, aren't we? She's impacted way beyond what we thought might have been, and people from all over and many different walks of life. And indeed, there's people here already from all over Western Sydney, and the multicultural nature of who we've got is astounding as well.
Some there only became fans of the late Queen in recent years, but nonetheless wanted to reflect on her life.
I've recently converted from a Republican to a monarchist, and so I'm going full force into monarchy.
How did that conversion happen?
As sad as it sounds, I watched The Crown on Netflix. And it really made me appreciate how much the Queen has done and how, over 70 years, barely a scandal. It was very inspirational.
Across Sydney, it was a similar sentiment. Pubgoers taking the day to remember a popular and respected figure.
Yeah, it's a very sad time after that happening. Like, a lifetime of her royalness is sad. And I think today is a good celebration for her passing.
It's not just about whether you're a monarchist or not. I think it's about respect. And, you know, she served us well, and today we take the day off to remember her. Good on her. I think I'm on to my third beer and having a more. Long may she be remembered, and long may King Charles III reign.
And you're not quite agreeing there. What do you think about it all?
Well, I'm not a monarchist. I respect the woman as a woman, but the idea of monarchy in the 21st century, I don't think is a valid concept.
How are you spending this day of mourning?
Well, what we're trying to do is celebrate the Queen. That's what this day is all about. And what my son and I have been doing is visiting all the British hotels in the Rocks area. And we're just enjoying the drinks in the day. We've been to three places and we've probably got another six to go to.
Sounds like you've got a long day ahead.
We have.
And I guess for you, is it more than a public holiday? What did the Queen mean to you?
She means a lot to me personally. I'm a royalist by heart. It's sad to see her go. I just hope the next king is as good as she has been.
Pubgoers in Sydney speaking with Sarah Sedgy. The field of artificial intelligence is making rapid advances, and the technology is being employed in almost every element of society you can think of, from cars to hospitals and supermarket checkout cameras. But for one of the world's biggest stock photo libraries, AI art is being seen as a bridge too far. Getty Images is banning AI-originated content and art amid concerns over copyright, as Angus Randall reports.
Freelance photographer Nat Rogers has been behind the lens for 18 years. For her, capturing reality is part of the job.
I think there's sort of like a myth that photographers are trying to sort of like create something in editorial work that's like not there. We provide as best we can the truth of the situation. Life is not so simple as just one, 250th of a second of somebody's life.
But for some artists, reality is overrated. Artificial intelligence could be the next big thing in the art and photography world. It offers a cheap alternative to commissioning a unique piece of art, simply by typing in what you want into an AI art generator. Rodolfo Ocampo is a PhD student and AI artist at the University of New South Wales.
So these algorithms are trained with pretty much all the publicly available images on the internet. And what the training does is it trains the algorithm to be able to match a caption and an image. So you can say something like, give me a photo of a dog jumping over water in the style of Dali. And it's able to do that because, through this training of millions and millions of images, it learned how these language concepts relate to visual concepts.
So that dog, is that a publicly available image of a dog somewhere else, or has it created a dog?
It's created completely, let's say, as a new dog. It doesn't exist, but it used millions and millions of images of a dog to understand what a dog looks like. But the dog that it generates is not a dog that exists.
The news image and stock image company Getty says it will no longer take submissions from anyone using an AI generator. As one of the biggest licensors of online photos, they're nervous about unaddressed rights issues surrounding AI art. Rodolfo Ocampo says the legal system isn't prepared to deal with the possible avalanche of copyright claims.
Obviously, since the algorithms were trained from existing photos, when someone submits a photo to Getty that might look like something that someone else generated, that someone else who took a photo manually with their camera might come back to Getty and say, hey, that image that you're putting there is very similar to my image here, and actually my image was used to train the algorithm, so you actually need to pay me some royalties.
It's not quite as simple as saying your image was used as one of millions to generate an AI image and therefore you should be paid. Dr. Kylie Pappalardo is a senior lecturer in the School of Law at the Queensland University of Technology.
The rule in copyright is that you have to take a substantial part of an existing work before it's an infringement. So it's not unlawful to take what is essentially a very trivial portion. It's not easy to know what is trivial or what is substantial, because the test is not just a quantitative test. It's not just how much, but it's how important is what you've taken to the overall whole of the original.
Street artist Yanni Wark is spending his day creating a mural at Penrith in Western Sydney. It's something tangible that passers-by will see and imitators will struggle to steal. He also creates digital art and says he's not too worried about being replaced by artificial intelligence.
It's funny, it's kind of like I always think of computers as, it's just another kind of tool. And the concept is reality is, to some degree people can imitate your artwork and they've been doing that for centuries kind of thing. I'm a bit relaxed about it because it's kind of like, yeah, whatever. Until someone rips me off, and then I'll be like, wah!
Street artist Yani Wark speaking with Angus Randall there. That's the program for today. Thanks for joining us on PM. I'm David Lipson.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.